John Clayton.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live at 710sports.com. On demand everywhere on the 710 Seattle Sports app. Now, John Clayton.
Hey, good morning on this Tuesday as we head toward the Super Bowl week. And, of course, got lots of things going on. They've now given the 115 players who have announced that they are coming into the NFL early entries. They have that coming out today. Now, that's been official. And then, of course, you've got more coaching news as far as who's getting hired as far as assistant coaches and that. You've got the Senior Bowl practices now starting to heat up. So those things are going on. And we got the five biggest stories of the day, the top five brought to you by Eastside Funding.
Number one.
I feel like I want to make sure I give myself a benefit of the doubt. I have been doing pretty good, but I feel like it's still something that's out there that I haven't done yet. Now, maybe it's just getting the ball in my hands more, more interceptions, I don't know. But besides that, covering, I feel like it's a lot better. Finishing the whole game, first quarter to fourth quarter, and feeling good, still be able to run fast and having enough energy to finish out the game. Even in the overtime, I still felt good. So I feel like all that is playing a part, and I feel like everything is great. It would look a lot better if I had maybe just a couple interceptions. I don't ask for too much, just a couple.
So that's Shaquille Griffin, and of course he gets the nod to go to the Pro Bowl, becoming the third Seahawk to go to the Pro Bowl. It was an third alternate, and so he ends up going in. It's kind of ironic because the guy he's replacing is Richard Sherman, because Sherman, of course, is going to be at the Super Bowl. So great season for him, 14 games, had 13 pass defenses, 65 tackles, and I'd say he gets a B-plus performance. And at least now with him being the third alternate getting into the Pro Bowl, that gives him he's the seventh best in the league this year, at least according to the players, according to all the coaches and all that. And so it's great to be able to see that. We'll see if any more. Now, Bobby Wagner did scratch himself. He's not going to the Pro Bowl. So he's not, fighting some injuries and all that stuff. Pretty understandable. He fought through a lot this year. He's always had that kind of that knee thing that he's always kind of getting tested on and all that. So, we can see that's going to be of note here. But overall, I think it's great to see Shaquille Griffin make it in. We'll still see that there's been a lot of movement. In fact, things were so busy today that five members of the Minnesota Vikings who were alternates all made it in to give them a total of eight. And I've been tracking it here for the last 24 hours. There's been about 30 players that have been scratched from the Pro Bowl, giving 30 alternates a chance to get in. So that takes the list from 88 to 118 that at least have been deemed Pro Bowl players, either by selection or by the fact that with the withdrawal of a cup player or two. And of course, the Super Bowl players obviously are not going to be there, and so that opens up the opportunity. So again, we'll still see how much more news is going to be there as far as alternates and getting in. The Seahawks had six alternates that I think had a chance. We don't know if Dwayne Brown, for example, because I know Lane Johnson just got in for Philadelphia. Kirk Cousins, of course, will be joining Russell Wilson at the Pro Bowl. He went in as an alternate today. So always kind of good to see how that's going and also how the voting went. But nevertheless, the Pro Bowl is going to take place Sunday in Orlando, Florida. It's going to be at noon, and it's going to be broadcast on ESPN.
Number two.
All this year, where I played with Seattle, I was just having fun. I just really thank the organization for opportunity. When I was 16 years old, and I came out in the big leagues when I was 19. And it's a lot of different things going on through my mind right now. I don't even know what to say.
Yeah, so here's the news out of Atlanta that Felix Hernandez was able to get a deal, a minor league deal, for about $1 million before incentives. And that's what John Heyman from the MLB Network was able to report. And so that means he's going to have an invite to go to spring training and see if he can make it as the number five starter on the team. Braves will be coming into town to T-Mobile Park on May 29th to 30th. So maybe there's an outside chance that Felix Hernandez will be pitching in that game, but looks like you kind of knew that he was not going to retire. He wants to go, and of course, it was bold of him to take the low money after all the years of making $26, $27 million a year to take it for $1 million just on the flyer. We'll get an update on that and much more with Shannon Dreyer. We'll be doing that at 10:30.
Number three.
I think there's a good chance that once they eliminated that no one's ever gone 100%. I always felt like Derek Jeter would push that envelope even further. But yeah, I think there's a good chance 100% is reached again, and we'll definitely see it again before too long.
Well, of course, it's going to be today the announcement of who's going to be in the Hall of Fame. Like I said, it's a busy day today, and that was John Smoltz talking there. So Derek Jeter pretty much is going to be 100%, you know, 213 votes received so far. Other notables, according to polls, Larry Walker is at 83%. There's Curt Schilling at 78.4%. Barry Bonds at 71.8%. Can he finally make it in? Roger Clemens at 70.9%. But, of course, that's it. If you're 71.8%, not good enough. You've got to be 75% to make it in. So there may only be two going into the Hall of Fame today. Derek Jeter for one, maybe Larry Walker. It does sound so good. The announcement's going to come at 3 o'clock today on the MLB Network and also on MLB.com. So big day, but Derek Jeter, you know, should be able to vastly get through and do all that and get into the Hall of Fame, and that's great, particularly a year after Edgar Martinez was able to make it after that long wait to try to get in. So, big baseball news, and I guess we're getting closer to spring training because the news in baseball continues. And, of course, again, Shannon Drader will be joining us at 10:30 today to talk about Hernandez and all the things going on in baseball.
Number four.
The new kickoff rules have been better because it's a lot safer to play now, but it's the unintended consequences that it's affected the onside kick. So we proposed a new rule change to try to get a 4th and 15 and one time a game in the fourth quarter to give you a chance to come back and take the place of an onside kick. It didn't get passed, but I think there's still hope with it. It's always hard to get one pass. It's just introduced, and so once the owners get more comfortable with it, maybe it'll be more effective yet next year, but we'll see what happens to the onside kick.
So that's the voice of John Elway talking about one of the alternatives that they're going to experiment in the Pro Bowl on the onside kick. And so there's going to be two options for a team after scoring at the Pro Bowl. Okay, the first option is give the ball back to the opposition at its own 25-yard line. And this is, of course, instead of having the onside kick. And so the new option, you serve as a substitute for the onside kick. It would allow a team, you get a 4th and 15, and if you can convert the 4th down, you get to retain possession of the football. If you don't get the 15 yards, the opposing team would gain possession at the dead ball spot. So that's one that at least if you're trying to make the comeback and you're trying to make a quick move and all that stuff, here's a chance that maybe if you can convert a 4th and 15, of course, I know the controversy here in Seattle was that, Pete Carroll didn't go for a 4th and 11 instead of punted the football. That has nothing to do with this rule, but again, 4th and 11s are tough to do. 4th and 15s are really tough to do, but still, there's an option because at least, hey, now you have a chance. On an onside kick, you basically don't.
Number five.
Defensively, the demands I want of the defense are this, and I told these guys already, whoever we play on Sunday, when they open their eyes in their bed, they remember, oh yeah, I played the Cougs yesterday.
So that's the voice of Nick Rolovich, who was hired and who's continuing to talk about some of the coaching changes and some of the things that he's able to do. He did hire former Wyoming defensive coordinator Jake Dickert to take over the position. And so he was 43rd in the country on defense in yards allowed. The Cowboys defense also finished 6th in the country in giving up only 17.8 points a game. And so Wyoming finished the season with 12 straight games of allowing less than 30 points. Pretty impressive. You know, Washington State, meanwhile, was 111th in total defense. I think you can see a little bit of change in philosophy there. They were giving up 450 yards per game. They ranked 93rd in the country in scoring defense. And so now looks like Nick Rolovich, who comes over with a new plan on offense. Again, it's the run and shoot. It's not the air raid coming in, and of course does plan to run the football a little bit more than it has than they do it right now for Washington State and Mike Leach. But Nick Rolovich making his moves right now, and again, I think we talked to people last week and most people think it may have been one of the better hires in the country. Rolovich coming over from Hawaii, and now of course he's going to try to see how he does in holding down Washington for recruits, because Washington's done a good job of recruiting Hawaii. Now of course Rolovich coming over from Hawaii may have a good chance to try to slow that down and get some players over at Washington State. Hey, you can listen to the show via the 710 Sports app. It's powered by the Dubin Law Group. Coming up next, we're going to go under further review and talk about the difficulties the Seahawks face in the West, the NFC West, because the division is probably the best in football. It's the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
Under further review with John Clayton.
We'll review the play.
Well, of course, under further review, you take a look at what's going on now in the NFC West. I mean, the San Francisco 49ers now. And I guess you can kind of say that the NFC West has been pretty well represented through the 2010s with, you know, San Francisco and Jim Harbaugh going to the Super Bowl, two Super Bowl trips for the Seahawks, Super Bowl trip for the Rams, and now another one for the 49ers, you know, with Kyle Shanahan and John Lynch in charge. And so Rams, of course, still didn't make the playoffs this year and are kind of going through a lot right now, changing coaches and facing players that may be leaving and all that stuff. But overall, it's a very good division, a division that's only going to get better by next year because you've got Arizona and Kyler Murray, who I think you could see is a good young quarterback and should, I don't know if he's going to be the rapid growth that we saw with Lamar Jackson in Baltimore, but you figure he's only going to get better and you figure they have to get some things done on defense. But overall, I know that this division was talked about much yesterday with Bob, Dave, and more.
This was the toughest division in football this year. What might it look like moving forward? I think the Rams are going to continue to take a step back. I said before the season they'd take a step back. I didn't think they'd be step all the way back out of the playoffs. I just didn't think they'd be a 12-win team or anything like that. I think they may take a step back. I think the Cardinals step up. 49ers look like they're going to be good for a bit. You expect the Seahawks to be. I think this will be the toughest division again next year.
Oh, yeah. I agree for sure. I think that for the Rams to get back on track, they got to figure out what's going on with Todd Gurley in that run game. I think that that helps tremendously. You see Kyler Murray with the Arizona Cardinals. What were they, 4-12 or something like that? But they felt a lot better than 4-12, especially when you come into Seattle and smack the Hawks like the way they did. San Francisco looks like they're set up for a few more years. Seattle, they're there. I think you need to bring in a couple pieces, but no matter what, as long as you got Russell Wilson, a solid run game, and Bobby Wagner.
Cards were 5-10-1.
5-10-1.
Yeah.
Yeah, felt like a 6-7 win team. With the Hawks, I think they bring in a couple pieces, and it's keeping going. The thing about the Hawks, they do the best job of making the best out of their situation. They don't have a super talented roster. There are some ballers out there, but there's other rosters that are way more talented, but they just find ways to win. I think that's their X factor.
I think if you get a pass rusher, that's going to make a huge difference.
In addition to Clowney, if they keep him, right? I mean, because you had Clowney this year and you had Reed this year.
No, I'm talking about, you got to get a couple. You got to get a couple in here.
For those that feel like, oh, we signed those guys, we're going to be fine. Well, no, you had those guys this year and you weren't fine. You need them back, and then you need to add to them.
And I agree with that. I mean, and that's going to be the key, I guess, now to the second season in a row. We're going to be talking about the pass rush because I know the story of this offseason was, okay, this team is good, but the fate's going to be determined by the pass rush. And it exceeded expectations. You know, the fact that they were able to, you know, win the 11 games plus one in the playoffs. I mean, again, without the pass rush, only 28 sacks. And again, where that number is so, because again, I know Dave Wyman and I always figure out, hey, you need about 40 sacks. That's pretty much the number that makes it work, but a number that they didn't even come close to. And of course, Jadeveon Clowney doesn't necessarily get the sacks. He's been to three Pro Bowls. He certainly is a Pro Bowl alternate, and my guess would be there might have been a chance that he might have been able to slip into the Pro Bowl had he been healthy. But of course, you know, he's facing that core surgery, and so now he's not going to be able to do it. That would have been his fourth Pro Bowl. But when you think about the need to get him back, okay, so now you've got a Pro Bowl alternate in last year in Bradley McDougal. Then Pro Bowl alternate with Quandre Diggs. I mean, so that's two safeties that are Pro Bowl quality. Then you have now Shaquille Griffin, him making it as a Pro Bowler. Bobby Wagner making it. I mean, K.J. Wright certainly had some consideration. Clowney, but you need that one quick edge pass rusher on the other side. And right now, it's just not there. You know, they thought they may have struck gold in getting Ziggy Ansah. That didn't work out. You know, the L.J. Collier was behind because of injuries in training camp and really didn't have much of a season. Rasheem Green is rushing and did some good things, but still doesn't look like that quick twitch guy that like Frank Clark was when he was here. And so they really need to do that. And of course, they have so many decisions to make on the defensive line. You know, they have to figure out, you know, are they going to be able to re-sign Quentin Jefferson, who had a good year? What about Jaron Reed? Are they able to get him back? And so all I know, Curtis, is that, you know, this team has to make sure it gets better and not worse, because the division is getting better, with the exception of maybe the Rams.
Yeah, and it's a young division, too. You look at the Rams, Cardinals, and 49ers, their best players are all young guys, and the Seahawks, you can kind of say the same, but I think Russell Wilson and Bobby Wagner are much more seasoned than who we would consider the best players on the other three teams' rosters are. Do the Seahawks have that next wave, sort of like what the 49ers have in Nick Bosa and guys on their defensive line? I think you could also kind of lump Jimmy Garoppolo in that as well. He's still sort of a game manager, but he's not on the other side of 30 quite yet. You look at the Cardinals, obviously their best players are young players. Kyler Murray, chief among them, Christian Kirk in the wide receiver group. They bring in Kenyon Drake. All those guys are young. So it's a division that's not only getting better, but it's getting younger. Are the Seahawks able to say the same about themselves, John, or are they going to have to look at more veteran talent in order to keep up with San Francisco? And if Arizona is going to leapfrog L.A. here, you know, is that another team to watch out for?
Well, I mean, the big thing for them is that they still have the best quarterback in the division, and they just have to make sure that they, you know, get a little bit younger and better on the offensive line. They've got to fix that up. I think that, you know, everybody's panicked about wide receivers, and I just don't see them necessarily being a big player in free agency. I mean, they got to take care of their own. That's why I think Clowney may be more expensive than they want to pay, but I think they need to pay it. I'm sure they didn't want to pay $17 million to Bobby Wagner, but, you know, once you had C.J. Mosley, you know, pulling in his big contract, now you had to top that. I mean, C.J. Mosley getting 16.5. And again, it's like you're not going to find anybody on the street that's going to be as good as Jadeveon Clowney. So again, they have to pay the price. And I don't know. I mean, Jaron Reed is kind of intriguing, but I mean, where do you think he goes as far as, you know, his kind of numbers that he's going to try to get?
Yeah, I know. Jaron Reed might be the most unpredictable free agent in this year's class across the NFL, because we've seen guys have him ranked in the top 10 of their rankings. We talked to Greg Rosenthal yesterday of NFL.com. He didn't have Jaron Reed anywhere near his top 25. I think he had him as just kind of an honorable mention. So to figure out where Jaron Reed is going to go, that's going to be the toughest part of this free agent class for Seattle. His price tag could be anywhere between probably $8 million, and maybe it even tops out at like $13 million. So for the Seahawks, I think if they want to be comfortable with Reed in these negotiations, I'd say $8 to $9 million is where I feel most comfortable with him. Anything beyond that, I'd say, well, thanks for what you did here, but we're going to go elsewhere.
Yeah, but I still think that they're in good shape, because, again, I think this is a team that's still on the rise, a team that is getting better. And, again, it's just now a matter of putting a few more pieces on there, because, I mean, you can see the advancement. I mean, you know, last 2 years, in 2018, they went to Dallas as a wild card, and they lost in Dallas. But then this year they came back, and I know Philadelphia was all beat up and didn't have anything at wide receiver, but they still were able to win that game. And so this is a team that just, you know, needs to make sure it doesn't lose too much. And, of course, like anything else, you know, the other teams, now San Francisco, I mean, they're probably going to lose some. Again, you wonder, and you know, again, they had the break of getting Nick Bosa with the second pick in the draft, and then they made the bold move of trading for D. Ford, who you know, came from Kansas City and wasn't too happy with the Chiefs and what they did there. But I think overall, it's still a good position to be in. But again, you just feel better if you get that one piece together, and that's why Clowney, I think, is so important to get done, because I think you see the difficulty of this year in the sense that, okay, so you're replacing three starters on the defensive line, Quentin Jefferson, of course, being the one, I guess you could say, that was a starter that was still came back. But, you know, you got to get better, and you got to get the defense better. You can't keep giving up 25 points a game.
No, it's impossible to survive in this NFL by doing that on the defensive side of the ball. But I think we talked about how the young talent in this division is on the up and up. The Seahawks, though, they find themselves in a pretty prime position to stock that cupboard. They've got, what, three picks right now in the top 64. Who knows how that's going to be come draft night. We know John Schneider loves to wheel and deal those draft picks, but you look at the lack of success the Seahawks have had in the early rounds. I think DK Metcalf, probably their best early round pick over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years or so. John, when you look at the Seahawks and just how much they really need depth on the defensive side of the ball, how important is this year's draft class as opposed to the draft classes of probably like the last 2 or 3 years? Is this one maybe the most vital we've seen in a while?
Yeah, because again, I think when you start to look at rebuilds of teams, and again, you have to call this now entering the third year of the rebuild, that's when you really have to start getting some things done, because again, the window usually is like 5 or 6 years. You know, the Seahawks were able to extend it a little bit more, but this is year three, because what happens is now, I mean, you can see more contracts are going to be coming due. I mean, now you have to figure out, okay, you're going to be paying Shaquille Griffin because he's going to be entering a contract year coming up this year. And what are you going to do with Chris Carson and guys like that? So in the end, I think that you know, you got to take advantage of the window. And again, that's why the key is winning the division, because you don't want to be the wild card. I mean, you can see how tough it is as a wild card to make it in. It's a very difficult thing to do. And so now to counter that, you got to make sure that, you know, you win enough games and take the division away, because now, I mean, the Rams had it. The 49ers now have it, and the Seahawks have to get it back. By the way, our playoff coverage is brought to you by the Washington Farm Bureau Healthcare. Coming up next, we'll talk some baseball with Shannon Dreyer. It's the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
John Clayton,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On demand with the 710 Seattle Sports app.
And joining us on the Zeke's Pizza Hotline is Shannon Dreyer. And Shannon, welcome back. I hope you had some time off and enjoyed it. I hope you did. Did you?
I did. I actually enjoyed just kind of being a normal non-baseball person for about a month.
That's nice. I wonder, did you travel anywhere or do anything? Or?
Oh, no. I travel during my work time. Yeah, I stay at home and do home things.
There you go. Not a bad move. I think that's the wise thing to do. Well, looks like a new home for Felix Hernandez. He ends up taking a one-year deal for $1 million. It's a minor league contract. Incentives are built there. And I just wondered if he was willing to take that low number, and apparently he did.
Well, it's not just the number. I mean, there are no guarantees that he's going to make this team. But I think this is about what we all thought would be his best-case scenario, what that would be available to him. He's coming off of a couple of really tough years, and not just in performance, but injury questions as well. So for him to get picked up by a team, and if he does make it, it's a good team. It's an NL team. It'll be something new, perhaps the possibility of a playoff, which obviously is something that he hasn't seen, but it's going to be up to him at this point. There's going to be a lot of competition for a spot. He's probably going to be fighting for a fifth spot in that rotation. But I think that, you know, that's all he wanted was a chance. When we talked to him at the end of the year, he decided he definitely wasn't done. You hope that he recognized that he was going to have to do things differently. He's been very quiet this offseason, pretty much off the radar. And you wonder if he goes into a new place, you know, A, what has he been doing in this time? And B, if he goes into a new place with new voices and in a situation that he's never really been in before. He's got to fight for a job, not just for a spot in the rotation, but if he wants to continue pitching, he's going to have to fight. Nothing has been guaranteed to him. Nothing has been promised to him. The fact that he's the king and he's got a Cy Young Award means nothing right now. It's all going to be based on performance. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. And yeah, I know it sounds like everybody is pulling for him.
Yeah, no doubt about it, because you'd like to see him come back. He meant so much to this franchise. What things do you think he needs to change?
I think that, you know, and I've said this, and it wasn't just last year, it was the year before. There was a change that needed to be made with him. He needed to adapt to what he was now physically. And I think there was a mental change, too, because I think in his head, he has always been the king. He can always go out and dominate. And I think in the last year, he finally figured out that, no, that's not true. He is different. You know, injuries take a toll. Time takes a toll. Things that he didn't do in the past. I think it's no secret that he had a ton of natural talent. And while he worked, he didn't, I think, always work the way that he needed to kind of advance his career as he got older. And I don't think he ever saw that. So you hope that the routine was different in the off season, and that's the first thing. I've always thought that he needed to get stronger, particularly in the legs. I think that he needed to buy into what his repertoire was right now and what his strengths were and lean on different pitches. And that changeup isn't the same as it was before. But you know what? You got a really good curveball. And, you know, if you can hit the corners with your fastball and you've got command of that, you've got a good chance. And he even started to experiment a little bit more and in incorporating the slider back a little bit more last year. I think that he is talented in the fact that he knows hitters. He can be crafty out there. I think that he can throw in a pitch that he hasn't thrown in a long time and probably use that for effect. I think that he can use location differently, but he's going to have to let others help him. It's a different game from when he first broke into it. There's a lot more that is available to pitchers. And if he opens his ears to it, and he's always said and taken pride in the fact that he's old school, you know, this is a guy that was brought up by Adrian Beltre and Jamie Moyer in his early days, and that's something that he holds dear. But that can only take you so far, and there are avenues that can help you if you are healthy enough as you get older. And if he gives himself over to that, I think he's got a chance.
No doubt. So that'll be fascinating. And it seems it's been surprisingly quiet on the Mariner front. Not many things happening coming from Jerry DePoto, kind of as quiet as offseason.
Jerry DePoto has traded one player since the trade deadline. And it's good to see. I think there were folks out there that kind of believe that, oh, he's got a trading problem, and all he wants to do is trade, and you're going to get these great players, and he's just going to trade them. No, he was trying to get to something, and he's gotten to it, and that something at this point is a big question mark. It's this year, I think, it's been very much put out there. It's about playing those young players, a lot of them that were acquired in the last year, a lot of them that had very good performances last year. Some, I think, that are moving a little bit quicker than anybody expected. But this year is about getting their feet under them, getting them as much time at the big league as possible so that they can make the adjustments that they need to in a year that I think obviously you're not going to go out there and compete for a division title. So there's a little bit of pressure off. But if you have that luxury and give them that luxury of getting that time, I think you can expect more the next year if you hit on a good number of these players, and we're going to find that out. So there really wasn't much of a need to make too many moves yet. It's a little too soon to be spending the dollars and adding to this core with the veterans and the players that are going to go out there and make more of an impact. So I think it was quieter. That doesn't mean that they haven't been out there evaluating. He's talked about next year is the year that they will be more likely to spend those dollars that have come off of the payroll, and it's a dramatic number. But he's also talked about perhaps starting that as soon as this trade deadline comes up. And I've got some thoughts that he's probably got his eye on a couple of players with other teams right now that he will try and target at the deadline if they see what they want to see in the first half. So this offseason, very, you could say uncharacteristic for what we have seen from Jerry DePoto, but when you take a look at the plan, it makes sense that they wouldn't do a lot with where they are right now.
Really does. Now, of course, today this afternoon, we're going to see the announcement of the Hall of Fame, and it looks like Derek Jeter should be unanimous, the second unanimous player coming through, but I don't know if there's going to be too much more, but thoughts on Derek Jeter.
Well, I think, obviously a no doubt first ballot Hall of Famer that he had a storied career with the Yankees. And I think there were times where there were some that thought, well, the defense wasn't as good as it should be, or, this year or that year wasn't quite what it should be. There's never been any question that this guy was going to be a Hall of Famer or a first ballot or perhaps even a unanimous first ballot choice. So absolutely no suspense whatsoever that Derek Jeter is going to go in. He obviously was the face of the Yankees, and I think some could say he was the face of the baseball for a few years there as well, and obviously got it done on the field as well.
Oh, no doubts. And, of course, more news coming up. It's going to be interesting to see as we continue to watch the crazy stuff coming out of Houston. What was your reaction when you heard the story about the sign stealing and then watching every story that's come out? Now the two firings of the general manager, the coach. You got the buzzer gate, I guess you can say now, because of the buzzers that they had in there. How stunned are you as far as that story?
Well, it's my feelings on it have really evolved, but the first reaction was it's about time. We have heard rumblings about this forever, and we've kind of seen evidence of it too. And it actually, I think, was talked about quite a bit during the World Series and how the Astros were changing up their signs as much as they were. And I know that when the Mariners went in, they would often, and other teams, they would often go with double signs because they knew things were going on or heavily suspected that things were going on. And then I think when you watch Houston, they would go with it too. And my, feeling on that was, well, they know they're doing it. They're assuming others are doing it as well. So they're trying to cover up. The extent of it, the means and how they were going through with it. I know that Major League Baseball said that they didn't find a buzzer. I wouldn't be surprised if there was a buzzer. My feeling on sign stealing is, if you're standing over on second base and you can pick something up, good for you. That's part of the game. If the video room is going to be unlocked and you can go in there and take a look, and if it's going to be available for other things and you happen to pick up on something, or if you're looking for it, hey, why wouldn't you do that? And that's on baseball to not let them be able to go in there and do that. But you cross the line when you go in, and we're going to have a dedicated camera for this. We're going to use electronic ways or a trash can to transmit it. Then it's going into a different area there. So I think they were out of line. They did take it too far. And when the first penalties came down, my immediate reaction was, okay, that's pretty strong. And I was reacting to the suspensions of Luhnow and Hinch. As it kind of went on and as you read the statement, the 9-page statement, I think that they really kind of went out of their way to make sure that it was more individuals than it was the entire organization. And in that respect, I've got a little bit of a problem of that. And so I think that, the initial shock of, okay, these guys are suspended and then are fired was pretty strong. And I think that can be a deterrent. I don't think any manager or GM wants to lose their job over that. But I think that they can come down heavier on it. They didn't go after players because they gave them immunity. Well, if you can go after players for steroids, why can't you go after players for this? That's something that needs to be ironed out. And I understand, well, it's not a good time to tangle with the Players Association, but you would hope that there will be more definitive language in the next CBA or actually before that will lay that out. And it's like, okay, you guys got one this time, but next time, you will be held accountable for that. The fact that the Astros, that it wasn't more severe penalties on the organization, I don't buy that people didn't know that things weren't going on. And if they weren't, that goes to the old college lack of institutional control, as far as I'm concerned. Ultimately, they're responsible, yet they really weren't held responsible. $5 million fine is nothing to a baseball organization. So I think that it's a good start. I think that they could be a lot stronger with it, and I think that they need to put it behind them as soon as they can, because obviously it's a black eye. And the only way to do that is to be thorough and decisive and really, kind of draw a line in the sand. We're not going to tolerate this, and this is what's going to happen if we see this happen again.
Shannon, great stuff. It's good to have you back. And you got the Hot Stove League coming up tonight between 7 and 9. What do we have on that tonight?
Coming up on the Hot Stove, you're going to hear from Evan White, who is always fun to talk to. He should have an interesting year ahead of him, most likely making that jump from AA to the big leagues. We were just talking about what's going on in Houston. They're going to talk to one of the Houston beat writers. Brian McTaggart will be on as well. And then one that should be a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun last year. Last week, the Baseball America is starting to put out their top 10 prospect lists for every organization. The Mariners list came out last week, and the man who was in charge of putting together all the voting and coming down with the final summary, Bill Mitchell, will be on. He's always a fantastic guest. He's seen most of these prospects, and the prospect game is his game, so it'll be interesting to hear from him as well.
Okay, that's Shannon Dreyer, and of course, thanks for joining us on the Zeke's Pizza Hotline.
All right, John.
Okay, hey, be sure to check out the professor's notes on 710sports.com. The professor's notes are brought to you by Infinity of Tacoma at Fife. Coming up next, we go behind the lines and check out the National Football League. It's the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to the Professor John Clayton,
live from the Alaska Airlines Studios,
streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
And, of course, we got the Senior Bowl stuff going on today. And, of course, the announcement that 115 players have turned pro, which is another big number, although it's not as big as the one last year. So it didn't get to be as bad. But overall, kind of interesting. And, of course, teams now getting ready for the Super Bowl, Kansas City, San Francisco, and, of course, the Pro Bowl now settling in. And, of course, Pete Carroll coaching the Pro Bowl. But how good was it to get Shaquille Griffin the chance to go there for the first time?
Oh, it was a great honor for him, I would imagine. I mean, I can't. He gets to go back home, essentially, because he played his college ball in Orlando at UCF. Camping World Stadium is where the game is going to be played at. So I can't imagine there's anybody more excited to go to the Pro Bowl this year, which is not really something that players look forward to, I would imagine. Maybe the guys who do get to go to their first ever one. But Shaquille Griffin getting to go home for his first ever Pro Bowl, tremendous honor.
Yeah, it really is. And, of course, that's going to be, you know, good to see because I'm sure his brother's going to be there with him and doing just about everything. And I just think that, I mean, and I think he earned it. And I think that his honesty after the season and how he addressed things, how he gave himself the D-minus for the previous season and now come back and, you know, cleaning things up, getting his body better, all those things. And I would have to think that, you know, it's a good example for Trey Flowers to be able to study what Shaquille did, because I know that Trey had been studying all season, because, I mean, he's the first to admit when things aren't going right. And right now, I mean, his development, I think, is now one of the most important things this offseason.
Yeah, I think for the Seahawks defense to get back to a level that we're comfortable seeing, Trey Flowers' development is going to be maybe the most important thing for this defense outside of, you know, signing players, bringing in guys, just of the guys who are already here. Him to take that leap in year three, because, I mean, he suffered a sophomore slump at the end of the 2019 season. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. For him to get back to what we saw from him his rookie season and really the first half of 2019, I think that's going to put a lot of people at ease if that does come Seattle's way. Hopefully it does, but easier said than done.
Yeah, well, yeah, no question, because that's the you know, that's the key right now, is getting better and all that stuff. And I think that's where everybody tends to you know, judge harshly young players and wants to get rid of them and replace them. I mean, certainly they have to have somebody to challenge Trey Flowers. But remember, wasn't the same conversation about Trey Flowers this year what was being said last year about you know, what was Shaquille Griffin? Because now people wanted to get rid of Shaquille Griffin.
Yeah, and Brady Henderson yesterday, he joined Bob, Dave, and Moore in the afternoon and talked about the Seahawks' need for another outside cornerback.
Yeah, in terms of another outside corner, yeah, I think that they've got to bring in somebody at least to compete for that job at right cornerback. And I'll tip my cap to Brock Huard, who had a really good stat, I thought, which was over the last two seasons combined, they've got a combined 6 interceptions from their cornerbacks, so outside guys and nickelbacks. I mean, that 6 interceptions was a good season for Richard Sherman, right? And I'm not saying, you know, that should be the standard, because that's, you're talking about a Hall of Fame guy there, but you've got to get somebody who could come in and take the ball away. And, you know, maybe that's the next step in Shaquille Griffin's evolution.
When you hear that stat, John, only 6 interceptions from Seattle cornerbacks over the last two seasons, what is your first reaction to it?
It's the same thing as the San Francisco 49ers, pass rush. Pass rush, pass rush, pass rush. Because you go back to last year, and in 2018, I think that the 49ers were only able to get 8 turnovers or 9 turnovers the entire season. I mean, it was a ridiculously low number. And when you look at their pass rush, it just wasn't there. They didn't have Nick Bosa. They didn't have Dee Ford. In fact, Cassius Marsh was their most effective pass rusher. And does that tell you what the importance of pass rush is? You've got to be able to get the pass rush to put pressure on the quarterback to force those mistakes. And it's nice to be able to say, okay, you're going to sit back there in man coverage or in zone coverage and be able to, you know, just get the ball coming to you. Well, you need the quarterback to be rushed to be able to do it. I mean, I look at that the same way. You look at Dallas. I mean, Dallas is as good as their pass rush is with the Marcus Lawrence. I mean, what was it? I mean, Byron Jones went to the Pro Bowl, but I don't think he got an interception for 2 years. You've got to get that pass rush. So the first thing that comes to mind with what Brady Henderson said about the 6 interceptions for the 2 cornerbacks and the outside cornerbacks, I put it on the pass rush. You've got to be able to get that pass rush so that the quarterback just can't stand back there and throw. And of course, now is even more challenging because you have so many running quarterbacks.
Yeah, and you look at the success of the Seahawks during their peak years under Pete Carroll. They had a pass rush. They had Cliff Avril and Michael Bennett and Chris Clemens and Red Bryant and all those guys getting after the quarterback. Brandon Mebane also on the defensive line. It was a lot of guys. It was a lot of, you know, productive guys, and their ability to pressure the quarterback put, you know, the secondary in a really great spot to make plays on balls that, you know, weren't really thrown all that well. That's why Richard Sherman would always come down with his 5, 6, 7 interceptions a year. That's why Earl Thomas and Cam Chancellor also had really high numbers in interceptions. And that also, granted, they were tremendous talents, guys who had a knack for finding the ball wherever it was thrown. But the defensive line really helped it out for the secondary during those years. I think the defensive line during that era of Seahawks football, maybe the most underrated unit, you know, on that entire team. Of course, you had the great secondary. You had a great linebacking crew. You even had a great wide receiver crew with Doug Baldwin and Golden Tate and Jermaine Kearse, all those guys. So I think that defensive line, it may be impossible to get back to that level of production because of how good they were, but to get something close to it. We saw the Packers this last offseason go out and get Preston and Za'Darius Smith. That paid off handsomely. Those two guys had almost as many sacks as the entire Seahawks defense did by themselves. If Seattle can get something like that this offseason, I think that's going to put them right back among not just the contenders in the NFC, but probably among the favorites in the NFC.
Mm-hmm, no doubt. And that's where you can see the growth, because, again, this was a year where the offense had to carry the defense, and it did. I mean, you know, you can talk about the close games and all that stuff, but if you can find a way to cut 4 points off your defensive scoring, now you're talking, you know, you can legitimately challenge for the division. That's what they have to try to do. They've got to get better on defense, and they also got to fix up some things on the offensive line. Well, coming up next, we're going to get a chance to go 4 downs with Sean Salisbury. It's the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.